This is WJBC This Week.
We feel we are very fortunate to get VenueWorks.
We're excited to see what we can bring into town.
It's not a matter of if, it's when we're going to have another terrorist attack, similar to what we had in San Bernardino.
I would consider walking in Chicago to be much more opportunity to have a violent crime happen than walking in the city of Havana.
It eliminates maybe the only sore point that we've had throughout the uptown development.
Some people leave the state because we took their services away.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, former state treasurer Dan Rutherford discusses the next chapter in his life, promoting tours of Cuba. Bloomington names a new management company to run U.S. Cellular Coliseum. Congressman Darren LaHood reacts to the terrorist attacks in Brussels and U.S. efforts to investigate terror threats. A Central Illinois genealogist links Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump's family history with that of Barack Obama and all 43 U.S. presidents. Plus, we'll meet this year's Women's Health Night keynote speaker, writer, entrepreneur, and former Ironman champion Nicole DeBoon. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. After a more than year-long absence from the spotlight following a sexual assault lawsuit that derailed his campaign for governor, former state treasurer Dan Rutherford has resurfaced. The Chenoa man is now selling private tours of Cuba, an island nation he first visited in 1999. He's taking advantage of efforts from the Obama administration to relax travel restrictions there. Rutherford talked with WJBC's Scott Lachlan this week.
There's a lot of infrastructure that needs to happen yet, but I have seen quite a bit of progress. And, you know, knowing our listeners like we do, the one question that I get from a number of people is it safe? I must tell you that the Cuban people really, really like Americans. I mean, they want to talk, they want to learn, they want to understand more. So they're extremely friendly. As far as physical safe, it is one of the safest countries in the world from violence. I mean, I would consider walking in Chicago to be much more opportune to have a violent crime happen than walking in the city of Havana. So it is quite a safe place. But and I get it. My contention was in 99 and now today in 2016 that the best way that we can help the Cuban people is to be able to interface with Americans. And it's kind of like the Soviet Union. You know, the best way to help bring about changes in a positive way for the people is sell them blue jeans, Mickey Mouse watches. Don't let a food embargo be the reason that they don't like Americans. And I digress, but it's a bit of history on Cuba. In the early 90s, the Soviet Union fell, and they call that the special period in a negative way in Cuba because they lost a lot of Soviet support. So they weren't able to buy food and get certain products, such that the people of Cuba that were born and young children during that special period are actually smaller or shorter. They didn't have the nutrition. So the Cuban government was able to use that as a marketing tool to be negative on America. So I do believe it's better for us to engage. We don't have to like everything that they are doing. In fact, I know we don't. But the best way to bring about change, in my opinion, and I concur with the president on this, is to be able to engage them.
Yeah. You know, I didn't want to get into the politics of it, but you brought it up. And Ted Cruz, last night speaking on CNN, they asked him about, you know, the president going down there, and he's got a real problem with it. He says, you know, we Americans, we end up going down there. We're going to pour millions and millions and millions of dollars, not necessarily into the Cuban economy, but into the Castro's pockets.
You know, I respect Ted Cruz, and he comes at it from a vantage point that few of us do, and the fact that his parents came directly from Cuba and were a part of the negativism that the Fidel revolution brought about. So I respect his opinion on it. When it's talked about the millions and millions, keep in mind that everybody on planet Earth trades with Cuba except two countries, the United States and Israel. And, you know, Israel's because of the political reason, the United States. Mm-hmm. The port of Havana is being redone now, and it's about a $5 billion-plus project. Not one penny of that is coming from the U.S. It's coming from Latin America, primarily Brazil. And when you do those kind of construction projects, infrastructure, I mean, okay, you know, that puts people to work. And people working in Cuba is important there as any other place in the world.
And I imagine they will make a lot of money is made on tourism, because you mentioned, I think we do tend to forget that, because we are not allowed to go to Cuba. The rest of the world is.
Yes. So, yes, in fact, go ahead.
So let me ask you, once we get down there, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, and if you want to go back to what you were going to say here in a second, go ahead and do so. My wife wants to go to Cuba. She wants to get there before we sully it. You know what I'm saying? She wants to get there. She wants to see old Havana. She wants to see the modern day history, the 56 Chevy tooling us around town. And she's afraid that once Americans go there with their millions of dollars, because it's a short hop, skip, and a jump away, that's going to be gone eventually.
You know, your wife is a very bright lady, and she's correct. There will be, let me give you one example. The whole idea of the vintage cars, there's a law in Cuba that the Cubans can't sell them. They can only pass them on to their family members. So the idea of an antique car collector from the United States going down to eventually buy up all the old cars and bring it back here, unless the law is changed in Cuba, that's not going to happen. Huh. Putting it in perspective, about 2 years ago, there was only, on the entire country of Cuba, only 100,000 American visitors. While in Varadero, which is a city east of Havana, there were 1.1 million tourists, primarily Canadians, Europeans, and Latin Americans coming in. So tourism is, I think it's the third largest contributor to their economy. So it's going to be very big. What the president did was change that you still need to declare your reason, one of 12 out of a list from the U.S. Department of Treasury, one of 12 reasons that you're going to Cuba. Religious visits, family visits, and people to people. And that's the one that we use through our travel club. So it is less restrictive to go, but you still have to declare. You still have to retain your itinerary. When you visit Cuba as an American, your itinerary can be called by the U.S. Department of Treasury to be reviewed up to 5 years after your visit to see that you fulfilled your people-to-people reason for going down there. The thing that I think will change, Scott, and your wife, again, is spot on. The thing that will change is you're going to be finding more American influence in such things like the development of hotels. You know, today there is no Marriott or Hyatt or Hilton. I believe someday there will be. You don't have Starbucks and McDonald's and others. That, I think, will probably be a long way from coming, but there still will be a great deal of influence on the American business. It'll probably start off more in things like technology, internet, cell phone service, capital infrastructure like water, sewer, bridge improvements from companies from the U.S. on that. But the one thing that, you know, those that want to visit, you know, again, our website is globalrelations.us. Those who want to visit, they don't have the capacity to receive the influx of tourists. So, for example, some friends, a group, and we went down in February. It took us almost 5 months to find rooms.
Oh, wow.
And, I mean, 5 months to just get rooms for a relatively small group of people. Now, maybe because I'm the one organizing it, is because I'm pretty particular. I know my way around down there. You know, we want to stay in the vintage hotels, you know, the converted mansions that are made into boutique hotels. The Hotel Nacional, the famous you know, Hotel National, where Myron Lansky and the mob used to meet. Batista had the casinos, and Frank Sinatra would come sing there. I mean, you can't get into those unless you've got a relationship and plan well enough in advance. And keep in mind, Europeans, Canadians, and particularly South Americans, the Latin Americans, are booking these rooms a year and a half in advance. So, albeit, you know, when the American Airlines and United and JetBlue start to be able to run commercial flights from the U.S. purportedly later this year, and I think that's great. I'm all about, you know, having that happen. It'll be a lot easier to get there. But before you get there, you want to be sure you got a place to stay, and that's going to be the biggest challenge for Americans, and in my opinion, Scott, probably for the next 3 to 4 years.
Wow. And smuggling cigars back. That'd be...
Well, the law did change, or not the law, but the executive order from the president changed that slightly, because now you don't have to do it like John Kennedy did as president, get 1,200 of his favorite cigars brought in the night before he signed the embargo executive order.
Wow, that's right. I forgot about that.
That's a true story, yeah. Up until just recently, you could not legally bring back Cuban goods into America. But today, Americans are allowed to bring in for personal use up to $400 worth of Cuban products, of which 100 of that 400 can be Cuban liquor, which primarily means rum, and or cigars.
All right.
And for any cigar aficionado, you know that if you're going to buy a Cohiba, Monte Cristo, or something like that, $100 doesn't get you very far.
That was Dan Rutherford with Scott Laughlin. Bloomington City officials announced this week they've come to terms with an Ames, Iowa-based company to run U.S. Cellular Coliseum, pending City Council approval this week. Tim Sullivan is Chief Financial Officer of VenueWorks. He talked with WJBC's Adam Stasinski this week.
First of all, your thoughts, just initial thoughts on being able to come into Bloomington and take over operations of the Coliseum.
Well, I tell you what, I haven't been to Bloomington for several years, but today, since I've been here, every person I've talked to has been so nice and accommodating. It feels like home to me, and I really think this is a perfect fit for VenueWorks and what we do.
Something I noticed, I was looking through and reading up on the company, VenueWorks. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, this is going to be your first venue in Illinois.
Correct. I think you might be right.
And so I asked the mayor the same question. Is this a state without a budget? Obviously, that doesn't affect you guys too much, but how do you come to, you know, what's the draw in Illinois? What's the draw for Bloomington?
Well, it's really the size of the market, the size of the arena, the number of seats fits well and routes well with other arenas that we manage. And also, like I said, it's in our main region, which is the Midwest. And as far as the budget problems go, yes, they're happening in Illinois. You see it on the news, but things are tight all over in every municipally owned building. So we're able to offer some expertise that some cities and counties may not have.
In the current employees at the Coliseum, you spoke about this. Sounds like you at least try when you take over new venues to maintain the staff that's on hand.
Yes, absolutely. We try and hire everyone that we can at the same or similar salary and benefits. We've found that it doesn't do anybody any good to make dramatic cuts or changes right on day one. We're looking for the long-term success of the venue, and the best way to do that is to take some time and evaluate things and see how we can help best.
How about as far as the management team from VenueWorks that will be on site? Is it going to be yourself, your new president? Obviously, you guys have a lot of venues to get to, so how does that work?
Yes, next week, our chief operating officer will be here along with our vice president of food and beverage, followed soon thereafter by our national director of operations and our corporate controller. In the very near future, we'll be making an announcement on who the local general manager will be. And so we'll be working extremely close with him on a daily basis to make sure everything gets up and running smoothly.
assuming everything gets through the city council, okay, you will be officially taking over April 1st. That's next Friday.
Friday.
Is this a turnaround experience you've had before where it's very short turnaround, it seems?
It is extremely tight. I believe we can meet the deadline. I would have maybe liked another 30 days, but that decision had already been made, and we are, as we keep saying, we are hitting the ground running, and I'm sure we're up to the task.
The contract, or the proposed contract, I should say, includes one of the big items that I think was hit on was the 5% gross sales of concessions, which is roughly 65% lower than what the current contract with Siam called for. Is this something that's typical in a contract you have with a city?
Well, I would say that the industry standard is probably somewhere around between 10 and 15%. The reason we're able to do it at such a low percentage is because we're grouping that with our base management fee and our advertising and sales commissions fee to pay for our overhead. And this wasn't a long negotiation process. This was the first deal that we put out, and that's just the way that our company does business. And I think it's going to be fair for everyone involved.
As far as reducing deficits, the Coliseum has reported operational deficits for at least a couple of years. How do you begin turning that around?
Well, it's a couple of things. It's booking more events, obviously, but booking more profitable events. And as I mentioned earlier, making sure that every penny of food and beverage sales that we can make drop to the bottom line, get there. It's a tremendous source of revenue and potential for any city that we work in.
What kind of new types of shows do you think you can bring to Bloomington? You know, they've had concerts here. They have hockey team, football team, and all that plays in there. So, you know, what kind of
sure.
new things do you think they can offer?
Well, much of the content that you mentioned will continue to bring, but depending on what the local market will support, there's no limit to the possibility of the types of concerts that we could bring in. Our vice president of programming, he was with William Morris Agency out of Nashville for 12 years, and so he's got tons of industry contacts. And the biggest thing VenueWorks brings to the table as far as events is a network of managers who are consistently, every week, they're talking about what shows are out there, who's touring, and what can we get the show for. So we're excited to see what we can bring into town.
As far as openness with the Coliseum, that's, again, something that a lot of the public has said they could be more open about reporting. So it sounds like you're going to have, after every event, you're going to be putting numbers out there and say, here's what happens.
Yeah, you know, we found with our model and fee structure, we're taking a flat fee and then a percentage of gross sales. So it doesn't do anybody any good for us to hide that information. Everything that we do at the arena belongs to the city of Bloomington. So it's public record.
That was Tim Sullivan of VenueWorks with Adam Stasinski. The suicide bomber attacks at a subway station and airport that killed more than 30 people in Brussels, Belgium this week brought the issue of security to the forefront. The attacks came as authorities in the U.S. tried to pull information from a private cell phone owned by one of the shooters in the San Bernardino attacks last year. Congressman Darren LaHood talked about it with WJBC's Scott Laughlin this week.
Have we ever asked you about that and how you feel about the government forcing, or they can't really force, but trying to get information like that from Apple? Where do you stand on that issue?
Well, first of all, you know, I think the incident this morning in Brussels, you know, highlights the fact that, you know, we have to be vigilant on this. And it's in the United States, it's not a matter of if, it's when we're going to have another terrorist attack, similar to what we had in San Bernardino, or another type of incident. And, you know, law enforcement has to have the tools and the ability to find out what's going on here domestically and around the world. So I'm a supporter of law enforcement when it comes to giving them the necessary tools. Of course, there's a balance between, you know, privacy rights and you know, what law enforcement needs to do. But as a former federal prosecutor that's been involved with some of these things, you know, there are mechanisms in place within our system to protect those privacy rights. But, you know, these terrorists and entities that want to harm America are going to all different levels. You know, if you saw what happened in the Paris attacks, you know, the encryption they were using there, some of the video games that are alleged to have been used there, you know, this, we have to go to a higher level there. And, you know, I've encouraged the private sector companies, whether it's Apple or the other ones, to engage in this dialogue and be helpful in this process. I will commend the director of the FBI, Jim Comey. He's tried to work with them. But the bottom line is, Scott, we have to give our law enforcement officials all of the tools in the arsenal they need to fight this. And in some respects, when I talk to people in my district, you know, if we have to relax some of those privacy rights for the greater good, I think people generally are supportive of that if it's done the right way.
If it's done the right way. But you know as well as I do now in this day and age, there are people out there that just live to crack codes and create chaos. They're out there. And if Apple were to supply a program that would allow the federal government to get into this guy's phone, somebody's going to get their hands on that. What's your concern there?
Well, your conclusion there that somebody's going to get their hands on it, I mean, I think that's what the issue is. I mean, we have to make sure that that doesn't happen, and we have to hold government accountable on that when it comes to those privacy rights. And structuring a policy or structuring, you know, a law or rules that we put in place, I mean, that's what we have to protect, and we have to give confidence to the American people that we are doing it the right way. And that balance, I think, can be put in place, has to be put in place, because, you know, our Bill of Rights is there for a reason. Our privacy concerns have to be there. But, you know, we're going to continue to have this argument moving forward. But if you look at what happened after 9/11, I mean, we relaxed many of the privacy laws in this country in the Patriot Act. And I think, you know, that was one of the reasons we didn't have an attack on our soil for 10 years because of that. And I think we're going to constantly have to upgrade that, always keeping in mind and being conscious of the privacy rights. But it's a balance.
Yeah, it's a tough call. And I say that, and I got this morning, and I thought it was interesting. A poll, who did this? 1,000 office workers at large organizations with at least 1,000 employees across the UK, US, Germany, France, Netherlands, Australia. 20% said they'd be willing to sell their work passwords to another organization. 20%.
Yeah. Yeah, that's scary stuff there. And you know, we have to deter these kind of attacks. And you know, and so we have to send a message out there. Law enforcement has that, you know, that you know, we're out there working in this field, but it is something we're going to continually have to live with. And you look at, particularly with ISIS, Scott, you know, ISIS wants to destroy our way of life in terms of our Western culture. I mean, they don't want our women to drive. They don't want our women to be educated. If you believe in Jesus, you're going to be beheaded. I mean, this is an element different even than Al-Qaeda. I mean, from my perspective, it's either they win or we win. And when you think about that, we have to go to another level here, and again, that's gonna put some stress on our, you know, Constitution and our privacy rights. But I think in general, if it's done the right way, people want America protected.
That was Congressman Darren LaHood with Scott Laughlin. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. 5 years ago, Donald Trump was among those claiming that Barack Obama wasn't born in the U.S., thereby disqualifying him to be president. Now that Trump himself wants to replace Obama in the White House, genealogist Ken Reveal of Arcola got to wondering how far back he'd have to go to find a family connection between the two from very different backgrounds. Turns out, Reveal says, they are 26th cousins, four times removed. In fact, Reveal says Trump is related to every U.S. president, as he explains in his visit with WJBC's Scott Laughlin this week.
Out of all the presidents, who is the biggest stretch? I mean, he is so far removed from a president, but somehow related. Give me an example.
Let's look here at Franklin Roosevelt, 32nd president.
FDR.
Yeah, he was the fourth cousin, one times removed, the husband of the half first cousin, seven times removed, the wife of the second great nephew, the husband of the half first cousin, 14 times removed.
Okay. All right. See, now that, now, and I was talking earlier this morning with Eric, my news guy, and he said, well, aren't we all related? I mean, because, you know, if you believe in the Bible and the story of Adam and Eve, aren't we all related? Can you go back, by the way, to Adam and Eve? Have you gone back that far?
No, all right. I went back to about 1,000 on some of my research.
All right, let me get this again.
Let me give you a little explanation of my thoughts here.
Okay.
Each of us have parents. They had parents on each side, male, female side.
Right.
We go back thousands of different combinations of people on your spouse's side, thousands of different grandfathers, grandmothers on your opposite side. There are thousands of points back there of couples that got together and made each of us.
Yeah. Grandparents who had grandparents.
You know, I have always wondered if you talk about Adam and Eve or you talk about Noah's Ark and the four sons and their spouses, of how you get thousands of people that made each of us. How do we go back down to two people?
Yeah.
How do we go back down to eight people? You know, war, famine, disease.
You make me sound so insignificant. All right.
Well, no. It took thousands of people to make you. It took thousands of people to make me.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Give me another. Could you have, you whipped out there FDR, right? How about Obama? How is Trump related to Obama?
He's his 26th cousin.
All right. How about, and that's just straight, nothing removed?
Well, it's four times removed, but it took four more times down one side or up the other side for him to be related.
All right. I'm not going to ask those removed questions again because I don't get it.
It confuses people. Actually, his straight cousin, not removed at all, is that Abraham Lincoln is his 26th cousin.
No kidding, because Donald Trump just not long ago said that he will be the greatest president ever except for Lincoln. He doesn't think he'll be better than Lincoln. I wonder if he knew.
He knows, because I don't think anybody besides me has done this.
Have you tried to contact Donald Trump to give him this information?
I decided to try to tweet him, since that's one of his favorite pastimes.
Sure. Did he get no response yet? All right, so what prompted you to do this? Look into Donald Trump's ancestry and connect him to all these presidents?
I'm going to be honest with you. With all the negative rhetoric going around in the campaigns between each of them, I said, I kind of want to see if Mr. Trump and Mr. Obama are related to each other. That actually was my initial incentive to do that. And it took me 6 months. I had to go back 700 years to make the connection to the Stuart name, which goes back to Robert II. And then all of a sudden I saw Stuart and his genealogy, and I went back and back and back, and it took 700 years, and it tied in.
All right. Hey, I don't know if you've done this. Can you figure out if Trump is related to Cruz?
I tried Cruz yesterday, actually. I really wanted to try that.
Yeah, try that one. Figure that one out. Get back to me.
Excuse me?
Get back to me on that one.
I haven't succeeded on that yet, and I don't think I probably will, because Cruz's lines on his mother's side are Irish and Italian. His father was actually from the Cruz's father was initially, or grandfather, I guess, would be was initially from the Canary Islands in Spain.
That was genealogist Ken Reveal with Scott Laughlin. A former Olympics trial qualifier and Ironman winner turned entrepreneur and author is this year's keynote speaker at Women's Health Night at Bone Student Center on April 5th. Nicole DeBoom, a Downers Grove native, turned her passion for athletics into a thriving business. And she talked about it with WJBC's Susan Saunders this week.
It turns out that your niche in the world after being such a successful professional athlete was giving all of us ladies something better to wear while we were running and cycling and biking. I love your brand of skirt sports.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, first of all, I did better than break even, so I was lucky. I was able to pursue racing professionally for 5 or 6 years. And towards the tail end of my racing career, I was just getting very frustrated with the options for women in the market. And this was in the early 2000s. It was very unisex. And one product in particular just killed me. It was running shorts, and no one made good running shorts at the time, and they always bunched, and your thighs would get chafed because pretty much nobody's thighs don't touch.
Right.
I mean, this is we have woman bodies, you know. We're womanly here. We have round bodies. That's part of, like, what makes us beautiful. And nobody was addressing that stuff. So I came up with this idea that would solve that particular problem, which was a running skirt. And it had built-in shorts, so your thighs wouldn't chafe, mm-hmm. They didn't move, and it actually had more coverage. And so you didn't spend your whole workout or your whole race tugging at your outfit and thinking about how uncomfortable you were. You didn't even think about what you were wearing at all. And I always take that as a sign of a really good test wear, when you don't even think about it, when you don't even know that you're wearing clothing, you feel naked. It's amazing.
it's a great line. Ladies and gentlemen, you can learn more about it at skirtsports.com. But I'm supposed to have you on, not so we can talk fashion, even though I really like what you've done. You're going to be the headline speaker at Illinois Heart and Lung Foundation Women's Health Night. And that's a big position. We invite both men and women, of course. Women's Health Night has now turned into an equal sex opportunity to learn how to get healthier. And you're involved in a sport that a lot of people shy away from. I know you're known as a swimmer, but let's talk running. How are you going to inspire us to, well, get out there and pound the pavement?
You know, I think there's no magic pill. And this is the problem, is that people really want a magic pill. What can I just take, eat, drink, take a literal pill, and it'll help me change my life tomorrow? It's really a series of small decisions that are going to help you get off the couch and move your life in a positive way, but it can easily be done. And a big part of what I'm going to focus on in my talk is finding those triggers that motivate you personally. We don't spend enough time thinking about ourselves and the things that really do matter to us most. And when you can identify those, it's very magical what you can allow yourself to do.
If you are not an athlete at all, and yet you want to come out to Women's Health Night and you want to learn a little bit about this and a little bit about that, what can you suggest to people to get started on any exercise, something that's going to make them just a little better today than they were yesterday?
I think a lot of people say, oh, I'm not a runner. I just get out and do 2 miles a day. Well, guess what? I don't care if you're walking or running. You're moving. You're active. We get chased call you an athlete, even if you don't call yourself that. So it's about reframing. Just the fact that you're getting yourself out the door to Women's Health Night is a huge, we have a step in the right direction. It means that you care about yourself and you're choosing to do something positive. For me, running's not, there's magic to running, there really is, but the first few steps, everybody's got to take them. And really, to me, running is moving your body forward, one foot in front of the other, at a pace faster than walking. So there you go. It's really pretty simple, and it doesn't have to be intimidating.
Now, you've been honest in some of your great articles for Runner's World magazine, again, I'm a fan, about how it's a sport that is always consumed with at least a little bit of pain. And there are many people that are trying to guide people away from running more towards fast walking or hiking or things that are a little lighter weight on the knees and on the feet. Do you think there's a safe way to run?
I think that walking and hiking are perfect exercise forms. I don't think that running is for everybody. Running can be defined in different ways. A lot of people think, I'm just going to go sprint down the street, but I'm probably not going to do you a whole lot of good right off the bat. And it's hard to remember back to when you were just starting, because if you've been running for a long time, it's very natural for you. But as I get older, walking and hiking are part of my routine. I only run 2 or maybe 3 days a week now, and I walk and hike other days as well. As cycling, which is an awesome activity, getting in the pool, oh my gosh, I'm so lucky that I grew up swimming because it's natural. But, I mean, it is a no-weight-bearing exercise that works your entire body.
But I'm so hungry. I'm so hungry when I get done with a long swim. I always think it's counterintuitive. That is the one sport that makes me want to eat my face off.
The amount of food I ate as a college swimmer, it's staggering. I still can't even think about it. It does make you hungry. Try swimming at altitude. Come up to Boulder, Colorado. Oh, my gosh. Well, that'll get you.
I don't know how you fit the oxygen mask on and still swim. Nicole, it sounds like you have had an amazing life, and without giving away all the good parts, just tell us what we can expect when we come see you Tuesday, April 5th at Women's Health Night. What kind of a talk are you going to give us?
It's going to be a very positive talk. In fact, the subtitle is Fueled by Positivity. You are going to walk away feeling like you can do whatever you set your mind to. Whether it's working out, spending more time with your family, reading books, you know, whatever that passion is. Exercise and health are a huge part of it. We'll dig into that and give you some specific tips. But really, it's about feeling good about yourself and the ripple effect that can have on the other people in your life.
That was Women's Health Night keynote speaker Nicole DeBoom with Susan Saunders. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. The proposed new manager of U.S. Cellular Coliseum in Bloomington is likely to take a significantly less commission on concessions than the previous manager. WJBC's Adam Stasinski reports Iowa-based Venue Works was recommended to take over the Coliseum.
The contract the City Council will consider on Monday calls for Venue Works to take 5% of the proceeds from concessions.
I would say that the industry standard is probably somewhere around between 10 and 15%. The reason we're able to do it at such a low percentage is because we're grouping that with our base management fee and our advertising and sales commissions fee to pay for our overhead.
VenueWorks Chief Financial Officer Tim Sullivan says a primary goal will be getting the Coliseum to operate in the black. Sullivan adds there's no limit to the kind of shows they can bring into the city as long as the market supports it. Adam Stasinski, WJBC and WJBC.com.
Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner standing by his new appointment to the Liquor Commission. Sue Feldkamp, a receptionist at the McLean County Center for Human Services, replaces Jeff Tompkins on the commission. A new group calling itself the Bloomington Area Restaurant and Tavern Owners says Feldkamp does not have the proper background for the commission.
Sue is a quick study. She does have relatives who've been involved in the industry, but I think the reason they don't like her is she's not going to be a tool for the local bar industry and the video poker, you know, multi-million-dollar industry in our community.
Renner adds being a liquor commissioner is, quote, not rocket science, and as the Feldkamp is regularly in attendance at the commission meetings. The Normal Town Council was signed off on a redevelopment agreement for a $14 million project called One Uptown Phase 2. The project currently calls for a 5-story building containing a restaurant, office space, and apartments. Councilman R.C. McBride calls it an investment in the community.
I think this project does two things. It eliminates maybe the only sore point that we've had throughout the Uptown development to this point, and it's the first domino to fall, as somebody mentioned earlier, for Uptown 2.0.
Normal is loaning $2.75 million to the developer for this project. A fire that destroyed Miller Whiteside Woodworking in Bloomington this week remains under investigation, but the blaze appears to have been set under suspicious circumstances. Bloomington fire officials released a statement saying the police department's criminal investigation division is assisting the fire department with the investigation. No one was at the business at the time of the fire, and there were no injuries. Christine Witt lives nearby and says she watched firefighters make an aerial attack.
Fire trucks this morning, I don't know, about 6. My dog started barking.
The building is a total loss. Anyone with information is asked to call Bloomington Police or McLean County Crime Stoppers. And one of Governor Rauner's harshest critics in the Illinois legislature says the state budget won't happen until Rauner realizes that legislators don't work for him.
If he decides he's going to continue to dig his heels in and say, no, workers' comp reform comes before taking care of kids with epilepsy or the people with mental illness or taking care of our universities, if that's his position, then there won't be a budget.
Democratic State Representative Lou Lang is Deputy Majority Leader in the Illinois House. He tells WJBC's Scott Laughlin the droves of people leaving the state isn't necessarily the fault of the state's economic and business climate, as Rauner contends. Lang says it could also be partly because the state has cut back many services during the 9-month-long budget impasse. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, the Bloomington City Council will consider a 5-year contract for Venue Works to take over management of U.S. Cellular Coliseum. On Tuesday, Kirk Zimmerman, the Bloomington man accused of killing his ex-wife, Pamela Zimmerman, is due in court for a hearing as he awaits trial. Also Tuesday, the McLean County Museum of History will reveal recipients of this year's History Makers Award, and state transportation officials will provide an update on high-speed rail upgrades in a public meeting at Uptown Station in Normal. On Wednesday, Heartland Community College will hold a 25th anniversary celebration. On Thursday, the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council will host VN by the Numbers, a luncheon that will focus on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. On Saturday, Illinois Wesleyan University will hold inauguration ceremonies for new president Eric Jensen. And Sunday, it's the opening day of the baseball season. WJBC, your voice for Cardinals baseball, will bring you the National League Central Division champions in their opener in Pittsburgh. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.